As we've already said, carbohydrates are contained in a vast and varied array of foods, everything from the most virtuous vegetable to the most decadent treat. All carbs contain sugars. These sugars, though, exist in several different forms and go by a variety of names, including maltose in beer, sucrose, table sugar, lactose in dairy, and fructose is found in fruit. Despite that similarity, no one who has ever craved a sugar donut has been satisfied by broccoli. The opposite might also be true, though it's difficult to find people who suffer from insatiable cravings for green vegetables. It's easy to tell by taste which carbs are highest in sugars and which yield their sugars most readily. It probably comes as no surprise that a milk chocolate bar gives up its sugar more freely than one made of dark chocolate, or a pineapple yields its sweetness faster than a grapefruit, or a slice of supermarket white bread produces blood sugar faster than a coarse-grained health food cracker. The more sugar there is, and the faster it's released, the more acutely we sense that sugar rush, the relief that courses through our bloodstream as we heed the call for carbs. Internally, though, our bodies treat all carbs in basically the same way. Digestion is in large part the process by which our bodies extract the sugars from carbohydrates and turn them into fuel, which we either burn or store. Burning the fuel is good. That means we're active enough to make efficient use of the food we eat. Storage of a little fuel is all right, but anything more than that is not good. You know that excess stored fuel by another name, body fat. The job of carbohydrate digestion starts in our mouths. When we chew the food into bits, our saliva begins the chemical process of separating each mouthful into its components. In our stomachs, the food is further shredded by the organ's muscular contractions and gastric acids. Our bodies want to get at the sugars contained in the carbs, but this happens at various speeds depending on certain factors. Essentially, the less encumbered these sugars are by other substances, the faster they enter our bloodstreams. Which substances get in our body's way? Fiber is a major factor that slows the absorption of sugar. That's the reason the highly processed oatmeal was worse than the steel-cut variety. The latter had all the fiber still intact, and so before the stomach could get to the sugars in the oatmeal, it had to separate them from the fiber. Once isolated, the fiber passes undigested through your system. Its dietary importance comes from its ability to slow digestion down. It's an obstacle to digestion, a good one. This was proven not long ago in a scientific study in which half the subjects were given the fiber known as psyllium, you probably know it better as Metamucil, 15 minutes before lunch. The other half had lunch without psyllium first. In the hours after the meal, the fiber group reported less hunger than the others. As the day wore on, they ate less too. The reason is simple. In their stomachs, the psyllium mixed in with what they ate and drank and slowed down the digestion. Slower digestion of carbs, less insulin, less dramatic drop in blood sugar, less of a sugar rise and fall now, less hunger later. Fiber isn't the only thing that slows the digestion of carbohydrates. Fat, too, slows the speed at which your stomach accesses the sugars you've eaten. That's why, in the study of overweight adolescents, the omelet breakfast created the least desire to eat more later. We have found other factors that slow the digestion of carbs and therefore benefit dieters. Acidic foods such as lemon and vinegar slow the speed with which your stomach empties, therefore cutting back on the rise in blood sugar. You can dress salads or vegetables in both and enjoy the benefit. Even sourdough bread, while not high in fiber, is acidic and is therefore one of your better bread choices. This is an important lesson in eating properly and losing weight on the South Beach diet. This is why we call carbs containing fiber good, and why we also think of certain fats as good too. Anything that slows the process by which you process the sugars and carbs is by definition good. Once food has been liquefied in the stomach, it travels down to our intestines, where further digestion takes place and where millions of capillaries absorb what we've eaten and transport it into our bloodstreams. Once there, it travels through our livers and then everywhere else in our bodies to be used, stored, or eliminated. But let's continue to focus on the carbs. As we've said, they all contain sugar in one form or another. Even the starches are merely chains of sugars. Digestion cuts the links in order to make the sugar molecules available to us. What we're concerned with here is the speed with which our bodies get at the sugars. It doesn't all take place at the same rate. Once the sugars enter the bloodstreams, it's the job of the pancreas to detect this and go to work, producing the hormone insulin in sufficient quantity to get the sugars out of our bloodstream and into the organs where they are needed, or into storage for future needs. This is where diabetics run into trouble. They ingest the same sugars as everyone else, but without effective insulin, those sugars remain uselessly circulating in the bloodstream. Insulin unlocks our tissues and lets the sugars in. Fortunately, the pancreas can tell how much insulin is needed to do that job. If the body experiences a fast infusion of sugars, a lot of insulin is required. If the sugars are metabolized more slowly, the insulin is released gradually. This is a crucial difference as far as obesity is concerned. Fast sugar is worse for you, slower is better. Again, when the sugars are absorbed slowly, the rise in blood sugar is gradual. So too is its descent once the insulin begins to work. The slow decline in blood sugar translates into less insistent cravings for more carbs later. You recall what I described as reactive hypoglycemia, the sensation of hunger caused by low blood sugar. When the decline in blood sugar is gentle, the cravings are lessened. But when your pancreas detects a rapid rise in blood sugar, it pumps out a correspondingly high level of insulin to do the job. That results in a rapid plunge in the blood sugar level. The insulin ends up doing its job a little too well. The blood sugar drops so low that new cravings are created, requiring more quick carbohydrate fixes. In order to satisfy so many cravings, of course, we take in well beyond the nutrition we require. We overeat, and this leads to more fat, more insulin resistance, more hunger, and more weight gain, a vicious cycle. Therefore, we can most easily stop ourselves from overeating by two strategies. One, we can eat foods and combinations of foods that cause gradual rather than sharp increases and decreases in blood sugar. Two, we can learn to anticipate hypoglycemia and avert it with a timely consumption of snacks. This one is crucial. It takes much less food to prevent hypoglycemia than it does to satisfy it. The third thing we all should do is learn which foods cause the most rapid rise in blood sugar. As we had discussed earlier, in the 1980s, Dr. David Jenkins led a team of Canadian researchers who devised a scale to measure the rapidity and the degree with which a fixed quantity of food increases your blood sugar. They called it the glycemic index. It lists most carbohydrates from table sugar, beer, and white bread at one extreme to spinach and lentils at the other. In the book this recording was based upon, you will find a sample of the index organized by food type. You probably won't be completely surprised by what you find there. Anything made with white flour is high on the list. That includes most desserts, breads, and baked goods, of course, but also pasta. Instant rice is also near the top. Certain tropical fruits are fairly high, as are some starchy vegetables, particularly potatoes and other root vegetables. The king of all sugars, the one that increases blood sugar faster than any other, is maltose, which exists in beer. Now you understand what's behind the beer belly. The rapid rise of blood sugar caused by guzzling this beverage stimulates a corresponding rise in insulin production, which encourages storage of fat around the midsection. Knowledge and use of the glycemic index of food is becoming widespread. But there is an important caveat which is crucial to understanding the link between carbs and obesity. You must bear in mind that the degree to which your blood sugar is raised depends not just on the glycemic index of the food, but also on the quantity. For example, carrots have a high glycemic index, but they are fairly low in carbohydrate density. Therefore, you have to eat several handfuls of carrots to approximate the total rise in blood sugar you'd get from a single slice of white bread. I have a handy analogy I use to explain this concept to my patients. Think of alcohol. When we drink it, our blood alcohol level rises, and when it goes above a certain threshold, we feel tipsy. When it rises further, we feel drunk. We know that when we drink on an empty stomach, we get drunk faster. If, on the other hand, we drink while eating on a full stomach, it takes more alcohol for us to feel the effect. This is because when the drinks mix with food in our stomach, it takes longer for our bodies to get at it and absorb the alcohol into our bloodstream, which transports it to our brain, creating the intoxicated sensation. The principle at work here is the more slowly the alcohol is absorbed, the less it affects us. Fiber, then, joins fat, protein, and acidity on the list of things that delay the absorption of sugars and starches. We need to include one or more of these in every meal in order to keep ourselves from getting drunk on carbs. By choosing the right foods, food combinations, and strategically timed snacks, you can prevent hypoglycemia and thereby control your weight without having to fight off cravings. A final anecdote to illustrate this principle. A friend and patient who was in his first week of the diet rushed one afternoon out to play golf. He had neglected to plan his lunch, so he decided to break the rules and grab a sandwich. As he played golf several hours later, he began to feel weak and shaky and recognized this as reactive hypoglycemia. There were no permissible snacks available, so he found some sugar packets and guzzled them down. They relieved his acute hunger and they tasted great. He returned home and downed a bag of tortilla chips and a chocolate bar. The binge was due not to a loss of self-control, but to his poor planning. Once the hypoglycemia struck, the consequences were preordained. Had my friend eaten tuna salad instead of a sandwich and had some low-fat cheese or nuts as a snack, both the initial hypoglycemia and the subsequent gorging could have been avoided.